Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. He's speaking to us from Vancouver. Welcome back to the show, Bob.
Now, hi, Jim. Good to be with you and good to be with our listeners out there in... What are we going to call it?
Cyberland. Cyberland. Cyberland.
Oh, hey, I like that.
Out there in Cyberland.
Good stuff.
Bob, a number of listener questions today. Our first one comes from our friend Justin in Berkeley. Hi, Bob and Jim. In 1999, Clinton and the GOP-dominated Congress repealed the Glass-Steagall banking restriction set up during the 30s. That pass rule made separations between investment and commercial lending banks. Later on, Greenspan shystered us away again with his sweeping rule reforms that allowed the aforementioned combined banks to invest your on-demand checking money in the casino as well. Does Bob think these sorts of past regulations would have helped the system avoid the liquidity and systemic problems we see today?
Yeah, Justin, that's a good review.
Yeah.
There is an example in history when the first great bubble, the South Sea bubble, crashed, and the British government came up with an anti-bubble act to prevent the flotation of so many speculative stocks. And then so that was 1720, and then the next financial bubble brewed up in 1772, and somewhere a year or so prior to that, I think they took the anti-bubble bill off the books because it was time for another one. They didn't know it was time for another one. So there you are, the Glass-Steagall Banking Act separated, as you put it, between investment and commercial banking operations. So here we are, we're brewing up in, as you point out, in 1999 and going into another period of inflation and financial assets. So they took Glass-Steagall off the book. So it's the same thing. When it's time to party in the financial markets, everybody conspires to allow or enhance or make the party bigger. So, and then Greenspan, you know, he was, as a young man in 1966, he was very critical of the Federal Reserve System. And then, of all things, he then became Fed chairman. And there were times when he was Fed chairman, I thought he was deliberately trying to blow it up so that it could be replaced with something else. But anyways, it was time for a financial party. And everybody, all agencies, participate in it, and there's not much one can do about it. It just happens. So, and then, bang, when the crash comes in, they'll be slamming barn doors after the horse is bolted. So, yeah.
Our next question comes from Sam. Bob, there are many commentators predicting a financial crash in 2023. Firstly, under what circumstances could they be wrong? And secondly, do most equity market crashes start or melt down in the months of September, October? Thank you, Jim and Bob, for continuing my financial education.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. Yeah, the, well, actually, beginning year ago in January, that was a crash. You know, the standard portfolio of 60% equities and 40% bonds took the worst trashing since the 1930s. So, and then you had the collapse of the wild stuff, cryptos and stuff like that. So it's been in a early part of a post-bubble contraction. So then many commentators are predicting a financial crash. Yeah, there will be hits, let's put it this way, in the post-bubble contraction. And then the part about financial problems in being discovered in the fall. The earliest I found in that was in Florence, in those prosperous, more or less city-states in northern Italy. And it was 1347 or something like that. And the main instrument being traded was mortgages. And there was a massive liquidity problem. And an Italian financial historian, my name is Cipolla, wrote an excellent book on it. And, the worst parts of that calamity were in the fall of the year. And that was the earliest I could discover. So what's going to happen this fall? Oh, probably some hits to the financial markets. So thanks for the question.
Multiple questions from our friend David. Hi, Bob. With all the failures and thefts at U.S. banks, can we trust Canadian banks? Are there similar issues at this side of the border?
Canada has had a much sounder banking system than in the U.S. The problem with the U.S. banking system was something that limited banks from geographically diversifying across the states. So, like, for example, you had, I can't remember the name of the bank, in Chicago, Illinois, and it was the biggest bank outside of New York, but it wasn't geographically diverse. So now Canada's banking system goes back to, I guess, the Bank of Montreal in 1818. Montreal was the financial center at that time. And, of course, England was supervising things. So a startup bank in Canada, I think the directors who would put in their own money into the bank, I think they were liable for all or twice the capital they put in. So banks were very, very careful. Whereas in the U.S., there wasn't quite that discipline. So Canada's had a very sound banking system with the four, years ago, the four big banks right across the country. So you had geographical diversity. And then, when was it? Late 60s, early 70s, the U.S. came in with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp. So they came in with a deposit insurance thing that then actually allows more reckless central banking commercial banking to develop. And, of course, in Canada they followed, but there was absolutely no need for it. The deposit insurance actually allows or enhances irregular banking. So, but in Canada, in the 1930s, the U.S., I mean, banks were shutting down, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 a year kind of thing. But then they were isolated little banks all across the country, whereas in Canada, there were no bank failures, but I'm quite sure that a number of the branches of, say, Royal Bank or TD were shut down. So, but there was they didn't fail. So, and the coming problems, I don't know. I certainly wouldn't be in Canadian bank stocks. They've weathered the storm reasonably well, but the storm isn't over yet. So, now let's see now, bailouts. Also, do you think these high interest-bearing ETFs and bank deposits are safe? No, anything high yield is at risk. So the problem is the safest thing is in cash. But in a post-bubble contraction, cash picks up purchasing power. So it's not as if you're having to suffer currency depreciation with inflation. And inflation's over, and financial inflation's over. Commodity inflation is over, and we're going into a post-bubble contraction. Thanks for the question, David.
Yeah, I think, and there's another part to this question. In Iceland, I think they sent bank CEOs to jail for allowing their banks to get into trouble and to fail. Should that same system be used in North America? If you run your bank irresponsibly, you personally have to pay a price for it, not just write it off and collect a big bonus at the end of it, like they did with the Silicon Valley Bank. They paid themselves a big bonus the day before it went under.
That. This is all part of the corruption of our times. Yeah. That the Iceland story is an example of when you're in a financial there was, you know, crazy financial markets then, and then the crash. Even a place like Iceland is not isolated from financial contractions. So, yeah. And also, it was, if you know a little bit about the language in Iceland, it's pronounced Eastland, which, of course, is the old way of spelling island in the old way of saying it. So it's doesn't necessarily mean Iceland. It meant Eastland. So I picked that up from somebody ages ago. But it's always interesting out there. Now let's see question four.
The question four comes from A. Campbell. After merging UBS with Credit Suisse last week and the central bankers assuring us how robust the overleveraged banking system is, Deutsche Bank stock today is under pressure, suggesting the crisis is far from over and has been discovered way ahead of fall. Even though I understand that gold coins are optimally shaped to plug holes in Swiss cheese, is gold not heading into a cyclical top in the coming weeks as an asset with no counterparty risk that thrives on fear and economic and financial uncertainty, but drops eventually as miners see their production costs plummet?
Yeah.
So does gold work to protect us if the banking system's in trouble?
The merging of UBS with Credit Suisse, it seems that the pattern is when a bubble ends, like 1929, and you get the massive hit, and I researched it a few weeks ago that it's the following year where the bank runs and the bank failures occur. So in the late 1920s, a bank in Austria, Credit Anstalt, was a very big bank backed originally by Rothschilds. So when pressures were developing, even before the bubble was over, authorities in Europe encouraged Credit Anstalt to bail out these smaller banks, which they did, and through into 1930. But then it was in May of 1931 where all of a sudden they discovered that the bailout bank was a disaster. So that was a very big hit, not just to European markets, but also to England and North America when Credit Anstalt failed in May of 1931. So these are just measures where the current banking officials think it's going to work. And then, sadly, Deutsche Bank is getting the hit. And it'll continue. Now, I like the line about gold coins shaped to plug the holes in the Swiss cheese. Gold, as measured in U.S. dollars, trades up and down in dollar terms, and, of course, gets excessive either on the down or on the up. That's good technical research can call those things, but where we are, what the best way to look at gold is with its real price. For decades, I looked at it as deflated by the price inflation. But that CPI is published monthly. It's no fun at all. So it was last June when I got on the idea of, oh, let's deflate gold by the CRB, by commodities. Oh, and it was really good. Exceptionally oversold in June. And it's a proxy for the earnings for gold mining. I mean, yeah, what are the costs for gold mining? Crude oil, energy, wages, equipment, all that sort of stuff, tires, everything. So anyways, in the final stages of a bubble, and copper goes up and base metal mining does well. But gold's real price goes down and the gold miners don't do so well. And then when the bubble's over, it reverses so that mining, base metal mining heads down and the profitability for gold mining heads up. And now it's really easy to grasp because on a gold mine, you might have about 60% of the costs energy related. And crude oil prices or net gas are a proxy for energy prices. So anyways, we have already the prices falling relative to the bullion price. I think relative to the CRB, gold, CRB has fallen about 30% relative to gold, and the relative to crude oil, I think it's 50% or something like that. So as we speak, over the last 6 months, this proxy for mining costs has been improving relative for gold. So the way to look at gold stocks is on potential earnings increase due to gold's real price going up, or to put it another way, gold's cost going down relative to gold. And but the gold stocks are still vulnerable, and if you get a hard hit to the S&P, gold stocks go down. But eventually, a few years hence, the gold mining stocks like GDXJ will probably outperform the S&P. Now, one last question. If we're already in a crisis, won't bond prices continue to rally? High-grade bonds have rallied for the last 5 or 6 weeks, long treasuries. And then they, as the stock market worsens, there could be a flight to quality game in that one. And then, here we are. With long bond prices rally, lead real estate out of its current slump. No. The feature of a boom is that interest rates go up. And the feature of a bust is interest rates go down. And I remember guys here in Vancouver in 1980 at that incredible peak in real estate market, residential, and you had interest rates up to 20% or something like that. But they're all convinced that once the interest rates come down, the boom in real estate would revive. But no, it's the other way around. On any boom, it goes down and interest rates go down. So, but thanks for the question.
Bob, I'd also like your comment on Tim Cyclesman Wood in an interview I just did an hour ago said the M2, which is the immediate money supply. Yeah. That's what you have in your bank account in very short-term items and so on. That supply has been shrinking since late last year, and he says this has always led to a recession. And what's more, increasing interest rates only makes inflation worse when the actual money supply is already shrinking. In other words, the Fed and all the other banks hiking interest rates are making the problem worse, not better.
Money. Not just money supply going down, but velocity is heads down as well. So there's nothing the central bankers can do to prevent this contraction. They've had central bankers since England Bank of England was constituted in 1694, and the first great bubble was 1720. So since you've had modern central banks, there have been great financial bubbles and crashes. It's just the way it works.
So in other words, the central bankers should let the real problem, which is supply chain, be solved by perhaps easing up on making money so tight so that people can improve their supply chains, make goods and services flow easier again, and bring prices down.
Well, the thing in a post-bubble contraction is that prices do go down.
Yeah.
And real long interest rates go up. And the central bankers have been around for 300 years, and the great financial bubbles have been around for the same length of time. And they've never prevented a post-bubble contraction. Never happened.
Any solution to that, Bob?
Nope. It's the way financial history works.
So they're just trying to give you the illusion that they're in control.
Oh, yeah. That's what it's all about. We all know that when the yield curve inverts, and of course the curve is the difference between short rates and long rates, every inversion of the curve is followed by a recession. So, and it's best, I usually look at the curve, well, you can do it from 3 months, 6 months out to 10-year or 20, or whatever you want. So everybody knows yield curve inverts, recession. Now, why is the Federal Reserve System raising short rates? I suggest they're raising short rates because in a boom, short rates go up. So in order to look in charge, the Federal Reserve has to raise short rates, which inverts the curve, which causes the recession. It is a form of madness out there. Central banking, thinking that they can run things, is a form of madness.
We'll have more with Bob Hoy right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Bob Hoy. Some of the headlines that caught Bob's eye today. Credit Suisse shares soar after central bank lifeline.
Oh, yeah, that's the same old thing. Central banks have provided a fix, and quite likely it won't hold.
Just that risky.
Yeah, that doesn't work.
Yellen says the U.S. will intervene if needed to protect smaller banks.
Oh, yeah. This is outside. They formed the Federal Deposit Insurance Corp to protect those banks that got into the system and have been paying for the insurance. And then they're going to bail out everybody anyway. So, well, they're on a mission to save the world, you know. So, and that's a form of madness. So, but they all get hit. Here's one, the one about PIMCO, huge insurance company, lost $340 million with Credit Suisse AT1 bonds right off. So even the big boys get hit.
Well, if it's an insurance company, that means the clients are the ones who are going to pay the price, aren't they? They're just going to boost rates again.
There's no safe place.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong says borrowing costs surge driven by demand for cash.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're beginning to find that liquidity is interesting. Here's another one here on climate change. And this is from the Wall Street Journal. And the headline, it will only cost $130 trillion to address climate change. I wonder if they're going to have to fix climate every year. Is it a quarterly thing or maybe seasonal? Who knows? But me being a geologist, geophysicist from way back, I've viewed this climate change stuff as it's just a tool in order to control people. They're going to fix climate by increasing regulations and taxation. Sure, tell me about it.
Well, climate change is usually driven by changes in the Earth's orbit, yep. Volcanoes, asteroid strikes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we might be able to control asteroids. DART seemed to work. But volcanoes and solar cycles and the Earth's orbit, I don't see how taxes control that at all.
No, well, you know, and there are two on continental drift, plate tectonics.
Oh, yeah.
One that really was influential is when Antarctica spun off on its own. And that gave a circulation down there that has frozen Antarctica for 32 million years or something like that. Then the other was when the isthmus between North America and South America, where the Panama Canal is, when that closed, it changed ocean flows that really did throw a scut into the climate. And then you've got the Himalayan mountains that do this with monsoons. So the climate change is driven, yes, Jim, by orbital mechanics of our solar system and even actual continental drift and plate tectonics on the planet. And the idea that you can change the climate by changing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, that's absolutely absurd. And actually, at 400 parts per million atmospheric CO2, geologically speaking, that's at the very low end of the scale. Hey, for ages it was sort of 5,000 to 6,000 parts per million. And at times it was warmer than now, and at times it was colder than now. So actually CO2's got nothing to do with the actual temperature out there or the climate, but certain ambitious people in government have used it to, basically establish control over people.
Well, are they going to use these carbon taxes to chop the top off all the mountains in the Himalayas, which are getting taller every year?
Ah, I guess so. actually, ambitious governments will use anything to extend its control and its ability to tax. And but we're seeing the end of this. This has been on since about 1900, and it is now developing quite an urge to reform excessive and intrusive government. So I'm looking for change in the promotion of climate and any promotion to control people. I think it's going to change. Other people are going to throw it off.
Another comment I'd like you to make, Bob. Most Canadian provinces, with the exception of Ontario, have had surpluses this year. The city of Vancouver, a $500 million surplus, yet they're still jacking up taxes. Doesn't that prove they're already getting enough tax money? They don't have to hike taxes anymore?
Right. Bureaucrats want to harvest money. And the more money they got, the more power they have. So, old as the hills, yeah.
Give them more, and the more you give them, the more they want.
Yeah, and then when taxation becomes too onerous on a federal government with a currency, we'll then depreciate the currency in order to transfer yet more wealth. Oh, it's pretty evil stuff out there, these intrusive governments, you know.
Bob? Yeah. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Yeah, Jim, good to be with you, and I hope your throat gets better over the next day or so.
Nothing that rest and relaxation won't cure, which I won't get today.
Okay.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. If you have questions for Bob, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com, our YouTube channel, Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.